News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Gary Sauls about teens and substance abuse, something Christy and I have been wanting to do for a long time, given its real importance to really all of our listeners. But first, Christy, we're going to talk about some research, both about drug abuse by teens as well as about some really other important issues that matters to people.
Yeah, we have some astonishing statistics that just came out from the CDC, which is part of a National Youth Risk Behavior Survey. And this is the first time in this survey, it comes out every other year, that they've included questions about prescription drug abuse among high school students.
We're not talking about those high school students taking Percocet. Stealing it?
We're talking about taking drugs like Ritalin or Xanax.
Oh, all those Valium, ADD, attention deficit disorder medications.
As well as pain medications like Percocet or Oxycontin, taking them when they don't have a prescription.
What did they find about the prescription drug abuse?
They found that it was really extremely common. So it was most common among white students at 23%.
Almost one out of four?
And on average, it was about 20% on total. And they looked at Hispanics were about 17% and African Americans were about 12%. So a really common scenario that high school students are taking medications that are not prescribed to them.
So when my son and three of his friends are over the house, there's a really strong chance that at least one of them has been abusing some sort of prescription drug.
Sure. And most common among seniors at 26% and least common among freshmen at 15%. But that's 15% of 14-year-old kids reported taking these prescription medications when they weren't prescribed.
Well, and I know when we have Dr. Gary Sauls on the show in a little bit, we're going to talk about the drug and alcohol abuse, which I just found, again, it's not like this is new. I don't know it. I live it. I got teenagers.
Yeah, but the statistics.
72% of high school students using alcohol.
37 said they'd use marijuana. 37%.
Yeah, so
8% on hallucinogenic drugs like LSD. That's just astounding.
And this is not very different than 2007. I do think there's some encouraging news here relating to nutrition behavior, that our teens are drinking less soda and they're eating more vegetables, and perhaps some of the risky behavior of drinking and driving may be down, but these are still just huge issues.
But even still, almost 10% had driven a car or other vehicle at least once when they were drinking alcohol. 10%?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
17%
pretty
had carried a weapon.
Yeah.
I am not challenging teenagers that often in public. I can
no,
tell you that.
No.
I didn't think that.
Yeah. So we'll have more conversation about this in a little while. But
I think we just wanted to bring it out there. It's huge. We will continue to talk about this, bring information and research that matters, because we have teens that – as a community, we've got to embrace teenagers.
Absolutely. And this next study is totally different. This is a nutrition study about milk from grass-fed cows being potentially more heart healthy.
Yeah, you know, Christy, this article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition reminded me of something my brother, who is an organic farmer, used to tell me. He used to say, you know, our milk from our goats and cows that are eating on this natural grass are better than the goats and the cows that are getting fed grains. And I'm like, right, Brother Andrew. But it sounds out that he was right.
Well, so this is about a certain unsaturated fat called conjugated linoleic acid, or CLA. And there are some studies showing that it may have health benefits to decrease heart attacks. And apparently, cows who do pasture grazing for their nutrition have higher amounts of the CLA in their milk than those who don't.
Yeah, they found for researchers from the Harvard School of Public Health looking in this study of 4,000 people in Costa Rica where these cows, a large amount of land where they were grass-fed versus the grain-fed, that the people with the highest concentration of that CLA that you mentioned, Christy, had a 36% lower risk of a heart attack compared to those with the lowest concentration, again suggesting that perhaps drinking milk that's from these grass-fed has a more protective CLA, and this is better for you. I found this very interesting.
I found it interesting, too, that maybe just your regular milk made the regular way that nature makes it is the best way to do it. I mean, that seems like that should be common sense, but yet as technology has moved forward, we've been moving away from the more natural products.
Yeah, well, speaking of interesting, we have a great opportunity today to bring you some additional interesting information and research that matters from our weekend warrior, Dr. Ronnie Laney.
So this is a new segment, a new feature that we're bringing back. We introduced it on the show a few weeks ago. We're calling it Weekend Warriors with Dr. Ronnie Laney. And it's also a segment we sometimes like to call You Did What?
Ronnie, what do you have for us today?
So this is a great little story I want to share with you guys today. I was seeing this adorable little 87-year-old female the other day in our sports medicine clinic with her equally adorable 90-year-old husband. She came in with this several-week history of complaining of this elbow pain that she was complaining of. And I asked her when it started, and she said, well, it started a couple of years ago when she was kind of tending to their summer garden plot.
A couple of years ago. Okay.
Yeah. But it just hadn't really gotten any better. It was still kind of nagging her. So she came in for, you know, for further evaluation. And I said, well, what happened? She goes, well, it really acted up the other day when I got my new John Deere power tiller.
Oh, my goodness.
89 years old?
80, yes. And so there was silence, and I just looked at her and I said, you did what? So there's this 87-year-old lady out there, just a power tiller, just tearing up her garden.
Wow.
You know, I love that for all kinds of reasons. First off, as a gardener myself at age 50, I'm hoping that in 37 years I'm still out in that garden. And whatever she's doing some things right. But it sounds like there's some really serious issues here.
Yeah, so yes. What was the problem with her elbow?
So basically it's just what we would call a tendinopathy now these days. It's just a chronic overuse injury is what these are referred to these days, where there's just micro trauma to these tendons and they just don't really heal well. And so what I want to talk about today is this kind of this new therapy that's really kind of caught a lot of national attention.
Well, you know, I know that this is incredibly common. I would, you know, just, you know, myself, just a couple days ago, I was working to clean out a pool, you know, get one of those nets where you clean out the stuff that's on top of a pool out of a storm. And I spent about an hour because it had been a big storm. And I woke up the next morning and I felt all this pain around my shoulder and the arms, and I couldn't figure it out. And then I thought, oh, I had been doing this for an hour and yet I had all this pain the next day. So is it common that after an overuse injury you get this tendinopathy?
Yes, Abbott, actually it is. And in the acute phase or in the very shortly duration there afterward, there's just an inflammatory response by the body to kind of help heal itself. And so for the long time, the mainstay therapy was, you know, anti-inflammatory medication.
Motrin or Aleve, that
yes,
sort of
Advil,
thing.
Yes, Advil, all of those. And that was kind of the mainstay of therapy for a while. But we now know that actually is kind of counterproductive to injury healing in tendons that don't have a good blood supply.
Because it needs the inflammatory response?
Correct. That actually promotes tissue healing.
So you tell people not to take those anti-inflammatories?
Well, in the short run, yes, we do tell them to take them because that helps with symptoms and pain. But we do know that later on, as the tissue continues to heal, is counterproductive. So that's why there's this new therapy that actually promotes more inflammatory response called PRP that has actually caught a lot of attention. And Dr. Harry Stafford, who I've been working with here, who's director of sports medicine fellowship at UNC, is doing a lot of that these days.
What PRP? What does that stand for?
So PRP stands for platelet-rich plasma.
Platelet-rich plasma.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds scary, Ronnie.
Well, it's not scary because actually the great thing about it, it's not some manufactured drug. It's actually the patient's own blood that's used in this process.
And so how does it work?
So it works by you take a sample of the patient's blood and then you put it into what's called a centrifuge. You take about 50 milliliters of their blood and you put it into this thing which basically spins the blood at very high speeds. And so it separates the blood out into two layers. And in the bottom layer is this very concentrated platelet-rich portion of the blood that is then injected back into the patient.
So then you take that portion of the blood and you inject it where?
So over the affected tendon. And so you use ultrasound guidance to kind of find the defect in the tendon. And then you use a very long needle. And then you kind of perforate the tendon to make little holes to which will hold this newly injected concentrate, basically.
And there's some research that suggests that this is a good option for some people with tendinopathies?
So actually, the research is currently kind of lacking in this area, even though the procedure has been around for almost 30 years. Actually, it was started by dentistry back in the 70s for jaw reconstruction. It's now only recently caught the eye of sports medicine and orthopedics, and actually it's been tested recently in Pittsburgh Steelers football players. Mm. And so that's kind of how it got national attention. But so it's now slowly catching on into the sports medicine arena that, hey, this might help tendinopathies. And so there's very few studies, but so far most of them have been done on Achilles tendinopathies.
So more research
sounds
needed.
Promising.
And what about our 87-year-old rototiller patient? Is this something that would be used for her, or maybe not in that case?
Maybe not so much for her at this point, given the mechanism of injury and maybe her age. Right now, it's really used in kind of competitive athletes.
So if I was a sports person and playing tennis and needed to really be out there a lot and couldn't take off 6 months, it might be something to consider.
That's correct.
Well, thank you, Dr. Laney, for sharing something new with us today on Weekend Warriors.
Well, thank
you
for having
me. We're excited about the new feature.
Well, thank you.
So we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Gary Sauls about teens and substance abuse. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking about substance abuse among teenagers. And Christy and I have been promising our listeners for weeks, maybe months now, that we were going to really begin to start to grapple more with this problem. We've been bringing you research that matters, statistics that are alarming, and so we've really looked out for a guest that we could bring on the show that could really help us, who really deals with this on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. We would like to welcome Gary Sauls, who is a licensed clinical addiction specialist at the Duke University Department of Pediatrics in the Center for Adolescent Substance Use Treatment. He has over 20 years' experience working with adolescents and adult substance abuse populations and their families. He is currently coordinating Duke's Adolescent Intensive Outpatient Program and is involved in two National Institute of Drug Abuse-funded research projects. So we are happy to have you with us, Gary Sauls.
Thank you.
Gary, you know, this issue is such a big issue. It affects so many people in this country, and I assume it's worldwide. And it's one that I don't know, is any parent or any teen immune from at risk for being?
Absolutely not. You know, we typically think that teenagers with genetics are more at risk, but anyone can use enough to develop an addiction problem.
Well, the statistics alone are shocking, and we've talked about that a little bit already on the show. But, I mean, to think about how common it is, if 72% are using alcohol and 37% have used marijuana, and, I mean, 6.4% had used cocaine. I mean, these were high school students, 14 to 18 years old. And so just thinking of how common it is, I would think that no one is immune.
Whether you have money, you don't have support. If you ask the kids that I work with, they would say that everybody uses, but there are a few, you know, then you go in and interview kids and everybody's not using, but the kids I work with all say everybody uses. Starting with cigarettes and then typically moving on to alcohol and then weed and then other drugs after that usually.
So what does it mean then if these kids who are using perceive that the number using these drugs is much greater than it is? On the one hand, 37% are using marijuana. That also means 63% are not using marijuana.
Right,
and
right.
I remember back from the 1970s, late 1970s, the numbers using marijuana actually in high school were much higher than that, right, than they are now. So have we made progress or –
You know, I would disagree with the statistics, and I know the National Household Survey says what it says, but when anecdotally, when you interview kids, it just does not seem to be that way. I would guess that it's probably more like 50% use marijuana on a regular basis. That's my guesstimate from what I work with. And, you know, I kind of trust the kids that I work with and what they're telling me, and they are saying that it's permeated all groups now. It's not just the stoners and the skaters and the freaks and the, you know, it's permeated all the groups.
So is experimentation is something that seems to be a natural rite of passage for teenagers around maybe risky behaviors at some levels. So is some of this natural, and at what point is it not okay?
Right. As, you know, it's, as long as there's, you know, we have the mystique about it and the legal aspects of it, it's always, you know, they're just waiting because, you know, it's getting younger and younger and younger. Back in the 80s and 90s when I worked with kids who were 16, 17, 18, they didn't come in on Monday and say how many beer pong games they had played that week. And that's what college students do. And now it's, you know, it's just kind of graduated, kind of from my perspective, started in the private schools. And the older kids kind of pushed it down. And now 14, 15-year-olds are playing beer pong on the weekends and, you know, smoking, and it's well, I don't know where I'm going with that, but it's so prevalent. It's unbelievable how prevalent.
So a number that are really the types of ways that they're interacting with the substances have changed as well. It's
Absolutely.
A lot more about games, and it's social. This is all social construction.
All social, oftentimes played in basements of kids' homes with their parents upstairs. You know, the older kids have done it, and they just, it's the, you know, their rite of passage. And no, at least they're doing it at home, and we don't have to worry about them going out. And,
but that's not true.
Exactly. Well, the extreme cases, and I think you've probably heard of some of those, is parents will take all the kids' keys and try to go at it from that direction. Well,
we're trying to keep them safe.
And we're talking about 15, 16, 17-year-olds, not 20, 21, 22-year-olds.
And so what do we know about the differences of if some people try it once and sort of see it as a rite of passage to experiment, and for others that is a gateway into other drugs or substances and can be derailing for their whole life? What do we know about who is most at risk?
Yeah, this is the hardest question to answer because every parent asks that question because, you know, we look at it as kids go from experimentation to use, to more regular use, to abuse, and then dependence. And, you know, nobody, you know, with brain adaptation, you never know who that's going to happen to. Anyone can use enough to develop a problem. And so, the reality is who the kids who start younger are much more at risk. Mm. And so, you know, our goal in prevention and treatment is to try to keep their brains as clear as possible as long as we possibly can so they can have as normal brain development as possible so that maybe when they start using as an adult, they won't develop dependence, you know.
So as a parent here, I'm not as a doctor, but as a parent, when do you advise me to get concerned?
Well, if you come to Duke, we're going to say when you first notice that they're using anything, because a lot of us view any use in adolescent brains as abuse.
And so, but it can, you know, if we as a parent discover our child has gotten drunk, or our child, we find some marijuana in their drawers, should we go see our primary care physician?
Absolutely. First? That would be the first place I would go. We, you know, at Duke, all of the primary care physicians come through our program, and we teach them how to talk to kids and ask the right questions, not have you ever used, but when was the first time you used, to, right, you know, to get them to share what, you know, that they've been doing this. And, yeah, the primary care physician is the best place. And I'm not saying rush out and get a substance abuse assessment the first time they do something, but a lot of parents don't want to talk about it because they feel like if they do, they'll push it underground, and then they really won't know about it. And then before you know it, there's a pretty serious problem.
And what about other things along that line of being a parent, of what things to look out for? Because I'm sure the kids are not just volunteering to their mom, hey, it's my
right,
father
right,
day.
Right.
Do you want
right,
to have that conversation with me now?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
I mean, what are the cues for a parent?
You know, if they're family genetics, if you have it in your family systems, it's not a bad idea to, once they're 16 or 17, to do a drug screen on occasion and let them know that from when they're young, that in our family, when people use substances, and if they start at a younger age, a lot of them develop problems. And so let's go ahead and just as a preventative, let's do this once in a while, and, you know, just to check. And you know, a lot of parents say, well, I'm not supposed to go in their room because I'm supposed to honor their space. And that's just bunk. It's, you know, you go in and you look around and see what your kids are doing.
Sure.
There's so much that they're, you know, with all the media involved nowadays, it's really, with MySpace, some parents are aghast at what they see if they walk in the room and their kid left theirs up. And I could, that's a 5-hour show of what parents are seeing on there.
And what are the questions that you recommend? How do you advise parents to begin having these conversations? What are the questions they should be asking?
I think, you know, keeping it a dining room, you know, everybody goes in different directions at dinner, but having a dinner and sitting down and just talking about it. In our culture, we know you're going to be exposed to all these things. You can have the national statistics and that kind of stuff to show them. And just start, a dialogue so that you know them. And if behavior changes, then that's what we look for. You're looking for
school.
Start being dishonest about where they're gone and when they're coming back, and you can tell that they're being dishonest. You can take a 4.8 honor student and they start smoking marijuana, and it only comes down to a 4.6, and who's going to pay attention to that? But then you have the 4.8 honor student who drops to a 2, and how many Duke students have I had this year who have dropped out specifically because of marijuana? And academic suspensions and probations and blah, blah, blah. It just goes on and on. And so,
but if you notice your child is more withdrawn or perhaps evasive about where he or she is going, that those might be earlier cues before they get into real trouble.
Absolutely. Well, we're having a really great conversation here with our guest, Gary Sauls, but we're going to need to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue the conversation about teens and substance abuse. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Gary Sauls about teens and substance abuse, and we really were talking a bit about the transition from use or occasional use or exposure of substances in those teenage years, ways that parents can try to pick up on those cues and intervene early, and a little bit of that transition from use to dependence. And I know you do a lot of work with teenagers who are dependent on substances, and teach us about what works and what sort of treatments are out there.
Well, basically, parents call us and they want to bring their kid in and drop them off and have us educate them and tell them what to do.
Give them a vaccine.
Exactly.
And inoculate them against this, right?
Just like
at
the primary care. Don't go back with them. They're becoming adults. Leave them alone. But we don't accept that. And so if a kid in the Orange County doesn't have this, but in Wake County and Durham County, if a kid is caught using in school, doesn't matter if it's the first, and oftentimes it is the first time they bought a little something and they wanted to show off. And so they're mandated by the school systems to 12 hours of education, and they have to get an evaluation. And parents come to us and say, what do you mean I have to come to all of these? And we're family systems counselors and therapists in the clinic that I work in. And so we don't bring your kid to me to work with them. Bring your kid to me and I'll work with you to help them. And that's basically the way that we do it, because, at the end of the day, you're going to pay for the dentist in college and not me. And you have the biggest investment in this child.
That makes a lot of sense.
Well, Let's start. I want to come back to the parents. But let's start a little bit with the teenager. What are some of the insights and things that you share that might be helpful for those listeners who have teenagers or who have parents of teenagers? What are the insights that you learn from the teens? And I'm sure you've heard everything.
Well, at the end of treatment for us, we have different levels of care. I manage an intensive outpatient program, but at the end of treatment, when people are doing their graduations and their projects and those kind of things, I always ask the question in these multiple family groups that I run every week, what was the most significant thing? Why are we here today? Why are you graduating from our program rather than being one of the 40% who go off to long-term residential programs? And across the board, they all say the same thing. It was the lockdown process that y'all created when I first came here. You took away my cell phone, my car, my phone privileges, my life, basically, and put me under house arrest for a couple of weeks until I earned the privilege to have those things back. And across the board, that's what they say was the most significant thing that helped them stop using.
So the kids themselves are saying that by by cutting off those sort of temptations and their links to the people who may be influencing that behavior, that that was a single thing that really helped?
It is. And for and most parents think it's they'll not be able to do it. And, they, you know, and it really is the most significant thing that
so
helps.
So these kids come in and are they in the hospital? In the,
no, we don't.
But they're doing an intensive outpatient regimen.
It's where they're with us 9 hours a week for groups and then 1 hour a week for mandatory family therapy, which we know is the, you know, the most important thing.
So a child is moved to a place where a parent is concerned enough or others are concerned enough. They come. They get an evaluation. It's determined that, yes, this requires an intervention. Right. Was there an intervention before this?
Sometimes, you know, and a good percentage of kids have already failed before they got to us. They've seen a psychologist. They've seen a psychiatrist. They've seen social workers. They've seen their primary care docs, and they've not been able to stop in that setting. And then I can put them in an intensive outpatient program. We don't stick everyone into 10 hours of treatment a week. You know, we've some guys come in. You do 2 or 3 weeks, and that's enough. You just do a little bit of family work, and that's enough. And others just need more.
And then some of them go beyond.
I would say probably 40% of the kids that we interview, and there's myself and two other clinicians that I work with, and we interview probably 180 kids a year between the three of us, and about 40% of those we immediately send somewhere else.
And why? What is it about them that's different, and then what are the options for them?
They can't commit to any kind of we're an abstinence-based program, and they can't commit to stopping. If you're going to see someone in an outpatient setting, abstinence is a goal. When it gets to intensive outpatient or residential level of care, abstinence is an expectation, and most kids can't commit to that up front. And so we have to put things, you know, and
they have to personally commit
absolutely.
To that.
Absolutely. By the time they get to us, there are really bad things going on, and there are holes in the walls, and everybody's mad at each other, and the police have been called, and they're, you know, it's really horrible to, you know, the parents call us and tell me that, and they say, I know you don't want to see him, but, you know, that's my kind of guy.
So this is addiction, clearly, because
absolutely.
It's destroying
absolutely.
Social functioning and,
right.
and multiple domains right. of their life.
So we look at the emotional, psychological, social functioning, a spiritual functioning, not religious but spiritual in terms of do they have friends that are, who are good for them and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And so you talk a little bit about the criteria to be willing to commit
right.
that they're absolutely going to be abstinent.
Right.
What other – is this a whole spectrum of people with and without money to pay for this sort of thing or does insurance pay for this?
I mean, at Duke, we're pretty fortunate. At least I'm in a public program. It's a nonprofit, but I'm in a public program and we take insurance. We're not able – we run a deficit, so we're not able to take – to do sliding scale or do any freebies, but we do work with everybody that we possibly can. We have the Medicaid population. We have private. We have folks with no insurance whatsoever that can afford it to come in.
Well, that's something that I've noticed. I was working in the hospital recently and had a very young man whose family is being destroyed by alcohol. And and keeps coming back to the hospital to get off alcohol and then goes back out and has been in all these different treatment programs. And the limitation each time is on, you know, how many thousands of dollars it would take for a treatment program. They come up with the money and it's all very complicated in that way. And
it's
I would imagine for kids it's even more complicated.
It's very easy for me, Christy, to say that we use the levels of care to motivate kids and their families. It's very easy for me to say that. And then I know families that have spent $300,000, $400,000 dollars on their kid with primary treatment, therapeutic boarding schools, some successful, some not successful, and then a family who comes in who has nothing. That, you know, sometimes we're in the process of trying to develop an endowment to pay for some kids to come in our program because sometimes moms will come to me and say, Gary, we can't come tonight. It's gas in the car or food on the table and we're going to eat tonight. And so, you know, there are programs. We're really good at knowing what all the programs are. Everybody mm-hmm. can be treated. If you have money, I can get you in within an hour. If you don't, it may take a month for me to be able to get you to the level of care that you need to be in.
You know, go ahead, Adam.
I was just going to say one of the things that I'm hearing at some levels is there's desperation here. But I know because I know the work that you do that there's also hope. And I'm wondering if you can, because we're not going to have a lot of time left, tell us a little bit about the hope. I mean, because it's clearly you wouldn't be doing what you're doing if people didn't get better.
Absolutely. And so the phone rings every week, you know, once or twice, and it's someone with 5 years down the road who's calling to thank us. And, you know, today I didn't do it with the kids in the room, with my patients in the room, but I lined up all of the graduation announcements with all the pictures of all the kids that I've worked with this year and how many of them are going off to college and, you know, teaching them to go buy student health during their orientation so they'll at least know where the counselor's offices are and those kinds of things.
Because they're not inoculated when they get to college.
They are not inoculated.
No.
And a good percentage of our kids who are going off to college already have therapists in the towns where they're going to because during orientation, we've already scheduled an appointment. They're going to go visit some while they're there. Some parents are drug testing in college. But the traumas that we deal with. When I first started in this work back in the early 80s in 81, 82, you never had the death of a kid from this, never. And now it's so prevalent. It's every day. It's all over the news every day. It's horrible, absolutely horrible.
So I know that we do need to wrap up, but I have two more quick questions. Mm-hmm. One is, what would be your single most important message to parents to try to prevent this from getting to be such a problem in their child? And number two is, what is a resource, email, or phone number where parents who are concerned can contact you or others for service?
Well, everything that I know is not unique. And so Carol O'Connor was the guy in All in the Family, and he had a son who died of cocaine addiction. He did these public service announcements forever, and it's something that's resonated with me. And he said, do whatever you have to do to get between your kid and drugs. To do whatever you have to do. And, you know, don't pretend that it'll go away because it will not go away and things will get progressively worse even if there are rays of sunshine. You can call our clinic directly at 919-668-5559. Press 0 for the operator and you could ask for myself or another one of the clinicians in the clinic who does substance work.
Well, thank you for what you're doing for our community.
It's really amazing. In my faith tradition in Judaism, it says if you save one life, it's as if you've saved the world. And I think you probably have saved the world many times for patients and families. So thank you so much. We've been talking with Gary Sauls of the Duke University Center for Adolescent Substance Use Treatment. We do need to take a break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and experiences and the things that you've written to us and left us on our voicemail.
You can write us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can call us at 919-966-8081, and we'll address those questions. And we'd like to ask our guest executive producer, Carol Ripley Moffitt, to read us our first House Call.
Okay. I want to share an experience that may be a good lesson for other listeners. I have psoriasis in the ears, and because of the itching, I use drops. But despite the drops, I frequently put my fingers in my ear to scratch. I see a physician specialist yearly for this problem, and this year when I saw the specialist, I was having some pain in one of my ears. I was assured that it was okay, and my specialist encouraged me to keep using the drops. When the pain didn't go away, I asked my primary care physician about it, and he brought me into the office, took a look at my ear, and said both were massively blocked with wax. After irrigation of my ears on two occasions, 2 days apart, he got wads and wads of disgusting wax out. Not only did the pain get immediately better, but my wife said my hearing did as well. We often think about getting a second opinion from a specialist, but in this case, the second opinion came from my primary care doctor, what the doctor ordered.
Oh, well, that's great. Thank you for sharing that story. It's nice to hear the positive stories.
Yeah, and I'm glad it didn't end with the wads and wads of wax coming out of the ear, Christy. That would have been kind of a little gross ending, but this is a common thing that happens to people, which is occlusion of their ears, blocking of their ears by wax. It happens a lot.
And wax itself is not a problem. You know, your body makes wax, and that's okay. But some people make more than others. And if it builds up so much that it blocks your whole inside of your ear, then it can cause problems with hearing and cause some pain, and it sounds like it did.
Just the pressure alone from that wax building up, and then you have psoriasis, so you have the shedding of the lining of the ear, mm-hmm. which is going to make things worse. But one of the common pitfalls I do see, Christy, is a lot of times people will look in the ear and, you know, maybe they don't see it as well as they should, but the patient's not complaining of something, and they sometimes will say, maybe as a doctor, it's okay. My feeling is, if you can't see in the ear, there's something in there, you better get it out and find out what's going on.
Well, and over time, if you have that blockage of your ear, you know, that can really have an effect on your hearing, and it sounds like in this case it was bothering your wife enough that she noticed it got better.
We talk about second opinions a lot from specialists. We're glad you got a second opinion from your primary care doctor, and glad maybe next time even start there.
Yep.
What do you got next, Carol?
Okay. I have a skin condition called keloids, and they really bother me with itching and slight pain. I have four of them on my body as a result of gallbladder surgery. Is there anything I can do about them short of having them removed by surgery? And won't they just come back even if I have surgery on them?
This is a really great question, and thank you for sharing with us. I guess we should start out by talking about what are keloids, because maybe not everybody knows.
Yeah, so keloids are kind of an exaggerated response to the skin in response to an injury, usually as a surgery or being cut, and you get a scar that's not just a thickened scar, which we might call a thickened scar, but it's a scar that goes much beyond the boundary of the lesion. So it can get 3, 4, 5 times bigger than the original lesion, and it looks like kind of a mushroom, a thick mushroom.
Kind of bubble up and make
real
the scar
thick.
Look more raised and thick.
And angry and itchy and painful. So
mm-hmm.
And it's more common in more darkly pigmented skin, and you have to be careful about doing surgery as a physician if people have these, because they can form these ugly scars like yours, and it can be painful. So let's talk about what we can do.
So the question you're asking is, can they just be surgically removed? And your question is a really good one, is if you are a type of person who makes keloids that they form on your scars, wouldn't they come back? If we cut them out and then you had a new scar, wouldn't they come back? That's a really good question. And I think the thinking is there are some treatments that can prevent that keloid from returning.
Yeah, certainly if you did have them, and if it's so large that the early treatments don't work, because you want to get this done early, then some people would recommend, yes, you get it excised. And then while it's starting to heal, you inject steroids into that, or topical steroids to keep it then from reoccurring. And you may need to have that done for several weeks or months. If it's a small early keloid, then you could start this process actually on the keloid itself, which is injecting steroids, as well as giving some creams that could thin the skin.
And the idea with those steroids is that you block that inflammatory response of your body, and so that may reduce that swelling and that sort of bubbling up and thickening of the skin there.
But you have to come in fairly frequently to the physician. There are some tapes, that some cellophane that you can put on, and then the dermatologist can do some pulsed laser therapy combined with some of the injections. Lots of treatments available. Come see your primary care doctor. Come see the dermatologist. We'll get you taken care of.
All right, Carol, what do we have next?
I hurt my knee recently after starting a running program. I'm 62, healthy, and active. The problem I face is that my knee is swollen and painful, and my son's wedding is coming up. I really want to dance at the wedding. I'm taking ibuprofen, but afraid it's not getting better quickly. So I'm hoping that you guys can give me a magic pill that's out there to help me feel better.
Man, I would love to have a magic pill to give you or to give anyone.
Well, maybe if you click your heels 3 times, say there's no place like home.
I want to dance at the wedding.
I don't know about a magic pill, Christy, because I think we would say, could you get prednisone or aspirin? We could give you narcotics and you would sleep throughout the wedding.
But I think, Adam, it's still unclear exactly what we're dealing with. I mean, you say you injured your knee, but I'd want to know, how did you injure your knee? When did you injure your knee? Have you seen a doctor about it? Because, I mean, a swollen and painful knee could be a lot of different things.
Yeah, we probably want to talk with our weekend warrior, Dr. Ronnie Laney, about
and
ask about it. But, you know, depending on what the cause is and what's going on, the only thing that might be able to be done, and probably safely, but you'd have to talk with your doctor about it, you possibly could get an injection of steroids into the knee. That's done real frequently, and it could offer you some short-term relief that might get you through the wedding. I don't know of much else, but maybe worth talking to your doctor.
Same thing occurred to me, Adam. So go talk to your doctor and good luck and have fun at the wedding. Congratulations.
Carol, what's our very last house call?
I have a difficult situation and would like your advice. You recently described a case where a decision was made not to put a feeding tube in an elderly woman who quit eating after multiple hospitalizations. My father recently had a stroke, and the doctors, with our approval, put a feeding tube in to help him for the first week. He did get better, but he cannot swallow. He is confused a great deal of the time. He does recognize me, my brother, and his wife. But he's not eating at all, and if it were not for the tube, he would die. He can't move around, and he appears to be in a great deal of pain despite pain medications. One doctor suggested we stop giving him tube feeds, telling us that my father was dying. While my head says that perhaps the doctor is right, my heart tells me that there's a difference between pulling such a tube out and not putting one in. I have power of attorney and do not want to even remotely feel like I killed my father. Your thoughts?
Wow. Thank you for sharing this really a difficult decision-making that you and your family need to make. It sounds like you're starting to transition and think about quality of life, his comfort, and his connection with you guys, and trying to make some decisions about that.
And I would encourage you to whatever extent your father can participate in that conversation and have everyone come together. You know, I do think, though, you've raised a really interesting distinction that it's not exactly the same thing about stopping something versus starting something. It's easier not to start something, and it is more difficult to stop something, and it is the burden on you. And I could certainly understand your decision there. And, you know, when you have the difference between your head and your heart, I don't know, as a physician, sometimes I say trust your heart. But I don't know, Christy. I tend to want to trust your thoughts on this issue because you're in the best place to know it as a patient here and a loved one and a power of attorney.
And I would also encourage, as you're saying, Adam, the conversation with the family so that this doesn't feel like it's all on you to make that decision, that you have that conversation with your doctor and with all of your family in a family meeting, a series of meetings to make sure everyone is on the same page as much as possible.
Well, that's going to wrap up our house call segment, but I'm glad that we've had a chance to talk about some important issues like putting in a feeding tube versus taking one out.
A little bit about earwax and talking with your primary care doctor.
About maybe that magic pill or possibly an injection for knee pain.
And a little bit about keloids. So thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and to your health. And we want you to write us. It's yourhealth@unc.edu. That's yourhealth@unc.edu. Or call us at 919-966-8081. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com and searching for Your Health Radio.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great guest producer, Carol Ripley Moffitt, and our guest today, Gary Sauls. Please join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Take care.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.